Ho, ho. And welcome to the first 7-Inch Club, episode 26, the special Christmas edition. Mm-hmm. We don't have a Christmas record or anything, but, you know, it's Christmas. You'll probably be listening to this around the tree with your family. If you don't know, First 7-Inch Club is a podcast where each episode we dig up a 7-inch by a forgotten or obscure punk band. Not punk band. Why did I say that? A forgotten or obscure band within the realms of hardcore punk and metal. And So I wrote this down. If you guys don't know, if you can't tell, I wrote this down. And I'm trying to do it from the dome so I don't have to read it every time. But I'm failing.
I like it that way. found a recommend obscure punk band.
Yeah,
I love it.
Yeah, it just because I was thinking, I was like, I could do the kissing contest one. I learned that one super quick, but that one has more of a poetry to it. This one's real jagged. So, but we find obscure bands and discuss whether or not they're worth being remembered. We'll also provide factoids and trivia that we glean from the internet and our own personal experiences. Although we don't personally consider ourselves know-it-alls or experts, many other people do. And I am Mike, and with me is Scott.
We have no gift, but we are gifted.
Yes.
And I, all the way up to this moment, I kept reminding myself, oh, this is like a Christmas episode. I should think of something to do. Oh, this is a Christmas episode. I think like every few minutes I'd remind myself, and here we are. I haven't done anything. but Mike, more importantly, I want you to paint me a picture. I want you to spare no detail, really lavish it on. I want the full Oculus Quest immersive experience. Tell me how you celebrated Metallica turning 40.
I didn't know this was a thing. The first time I saw it was on Tom Ace's Instagram, and I was like, oh, mm-hmm. That's interesting. And then I saw it on a bunch of people's Instagram. So it wasn't like a secret that only Tom knew because he's a super fan. This is the thing that everybody knew except somehow me. So were you aware of this before it happened? Would like they're going to do like a big hubbub?
No, I just all of a sudden this week both of my friends Tom were talking about it, and I was like, "What are you guys talking? What is this?" And I looked at and just to get to it took a few minutes, and then I went to Amazon and fired it up.
Oh, so it was a live stream too? Oh, well, obviously because everybody posted it, so it was on Amazon. Yeah. So it was like, was it like a pay per view or is it just for free for Amazon Prime?
It's just Prime.
Okay,
but it started off with like a Long Way to the Top, if you want to rock and roll, that AC/DC song, and I hate AC/DC, so it was that quick. I just went, nope, I just turned it off. But recently, I don't know how I ended up on this, but I found like a clip of Jack Black telling jokes or something, and he gets interrupted by Metallica. Like Metallica's off to the side, and all of a sudden they start playing to kind of like jokingly interrupt him or whatever.
Yeah.
And they can't play their song. Like, they're trying to play like "Landmine has taken my sight," like that part of one, and they can't play it. But this is a tough part. That's a tough part to play. Like, you know, kick drum. That's the first time I ever noticed someone doing like crazy double kicks. So I went back and looked at a few older videos. I was like, have they ever been able to play this? No, they've never been able to play that part live. Mike, can you imagine like the Foo Fighters not being able to play their song? Or like Limp Bizkit. Can you imagine Limp Bizkit chat not being able to play their songs on stage? The biggest band on earth can't play, like it hasn't been able ever to been able to play their biggest hit.
You know, I have no proof of this, but I always, when I listen to rap music, I'm like, there's no way this guy could do this live. And I don't know, but you know, there's a lot of times, I mean, not even just rap music, but I guess vocally I could see it. But I guess when you're playing an instrument, because even there's even like hardcore bands where you could hear the punch ins and you're like, there's no way this guy could do this live if he had to punch it in on the record. But I guess, if you didn't know how to do your instruments, it's kind of like a real big cop out.
I'm not even a hater. That's like the default is to hate Lars and to wish he died instead of Cliff. I don't do that. One human being drummed on Master of Puppets. He's fine by me. Like I know he's a dick. I don't care. I don't hate him. I don't wish he was dead. I don't think he sucks on albums, but man, he sucks on ice live. He is unbelievably unable to play their songs. And it's like, I just never think about it. I've only seen him live a couple of times and they're so loud. You would never notice. They're the loudest thing I've ever encountered in my life. And it's not pleasant. It's really unpleasant to be at a Metallica show. It's like a monster truck thing. You know, you go to a monster truck show for the first time in your life, like, oh my God, I just want to leave. You panic. Like your ears start splitting and you want to be gone. It's like fight or flight.
He must be He must be like egotistical, Lars. He must be egotistical to the level that others cannot comprehend if he just doesn't do like a backing track at this point. Because every other band that got older and lazy, they have like fucking guitarists behind curtains and shit like that. Yeah. So you'd think Lars would just use a backing track at this point.
Well, one of the other reasons I don't hate him is I think he really like he may be bad at it, but I think he really likes music.
Yeah.
You know, he put out like a comp a long time ago of like new wave of British heavy metal because he's really into that stuff. Like he's kind of a nerd about a lot of that stuff. But yeah, you know, I just wish he'd practice. I wish he'd practice his instruments. He only has one instrument. Some people play two or three.
So I guess I have one. I have a couple topics, but the first one is Christmas related. It's pretty simple. I've just noticed a lot of people. I don't know if it's just because it's the COVID and everybody's inside and needs to feel they feel a need to share their opinions about everything. It just seems like there's a lot of opinions, more opinions in the past 2 years than I've ever seen people have about mundane shit. Like it's just ridiculous how many opinions people have right now. But it seems like recently a lot of people have been weighing in their opinions on Christmas, on whether they don't like it or they like it or they think it's stupid that other people like it. And it just seems like a thing no one ever talked about. Like, I mean, you know, there's obviously people who make it part of their personality to either love Christmas or hate it, but mostly everybody in between is just like, whatever, you know, I don't care.
Yep.
But it just seems like lately everybody has to take a stance. So I am wondering, Scott, what is your opinion on Christmas music?
Oh, Christmas, thank God. I thought you were just asking me about Christmas because then it's going to be mall goth. I was going to roll my eyes back in my head and I was going to have to fuck up the mood. But no, Christmas music, I'm fine. I love Christmas music. Okay. I love old Christmas music mostly. Like I like, you know, Andy Williams and like Johnny Mathis and like Nat King Cole. But I love the Waitresses, the band, and they have one of the best Christmas pop songs of all time. I like the song Nobody Likes by Paul McCartney. The Simply Having Wonderful. I love that song. I think that sounds like an alien who's never even had an ear on his head tried to make a song. But yeah, I have no problem. And I like old Christmas records too, because they would just be all around our basement when we were young. Like those, you know, the old Christmas albums that they put out for cheap to try and make a buck. They just take a really bad photo of a really ugly plastic piece of holly with a candle in it or something, and then just stick it on like a red background and just put it out. I love that a lot.
Yeah, I'm kind of in the same boat where I understand if I wasn't with my girlfriend, if I was alone, I would just probably be eating soup out of a can every night, just not doing anything. But if I was with somebody else who was just like, I don't care about Christmas, I wouldn't have a tree or anything like that. I don't really care that much for Christmas. I don't hate it or anything. I'm just like, I'm not religious, so, and I don't care if I get presents or not. But the music has always been fascinating to me because it's like, it's one of a kind. It's music that literally lasts for a month or two and then it goes away, but there's so much of it. There's tons and there's more Christmas music than anyone could ever imagine because they've basically been playing the same 50 songs on the radio since we were kids.
Yeah.
And it's never changed up. Like the last song they've added to the playlist is the Mariah Carey one. And that's like 20 years old now. Like that's the last one they added.
Yeah.
And, but you know, that stuff still comes out. It comes out all the time. And there's so much of it from all different genres. And like you said, the records, there's so many records. There's a documentary about guys who just collect Christmas records and they just have endless amounts because there's so much. So, if you're just a Grinch and you hate Christmas, that's fine, but you can't hate the music. When people say they hate the music, it's like, I don't know, I think you just have a pretty like basic way of looking at things, just because it's such an interesting genre of music. So if you are any sort of music lover, you have to at least like the idea and like just studying of Christmas music, because it's so weird. I don't really have any favorites. I always like stumbling on weird ones that you know, like maybe like outsider art ones, I guess I would say, like just outsider musician stuff like that's always cool. So I like all the standards. I like that Paul McCartney one. I like the weird David Bowie and the old man one.
Oh yeah.
Is it a little drummer boy they do?
Yeah, Bing Crosby. And
Yeah, Bing Crosby. That's who it is. Bing Crosby. Yeah, that one. I remember when that video would come on when I was a kid, and it looked old when I was a kid.
Yeah.
I mean, I was a kid a long time ago, and I was just like, man, this looks like the oldest music video ever
made. It would be on regular TV, like just Channel 6 or something, which would all of a sudden have a rock video in the middle of the day.
Yeah. So all that stuff I like. So yeah, if you're a Grinch about Christmas music, just stop it, because it's dumb, it's corny, just get into it.
Well, everybody who listens to this podcast should probably at least dig like the old timey stuff. Like you can listen to like Good King Wenceslas and those kind of songs. Those are grim fucking songs. I'm sure like Here We Come a Wassailing is about begging from door to door for some booze. That's pretty good. That's like a nice dark topic. And it's like, they all sounds like Gregorian chant. All you assholes like Gregorian chant a few years ago, didn't you? You all listen to weird shit now, like occult shit. It's been right there for you for free in the dollar bin for your entire lives. Go pick up like a church's choir version of one of those Christmas album. It's really, some of it's pretty bleak because it is medieval. Like a lot of it is like medieval music, or I don't know about medieval, but it's something evil. It's something evil music. And it's, my daughter's 4 and we drive around listening to this grim chanting haunted cathedral music because we can't agree on anything else.
I guess the last thing I'll say about Christmas before my next topic is that, if you guys are into Christmas music and you're looking for the sort of a deep cut, last year they released Silent Night, Deadly Night soundtrack on vinyl, like on fancy vinyl for Record Store Day. But you don't need the actual record. You can find it on Spotify. Just type in Silent Night, Deadly Night soundtrack and it'll pop up. And when I bought this, I usually don't buy records for packaging and like perks and stuff like that. But this, like, it's one of my favorite movies. It has like really cool packaging and like it has like a movie sale in it and a bunch of other stuff. So I was like, I'll get this. I wasn't really expecting much for the music. I was just expecting the kind of low budget movie score, but it's like a literal whole soundtrack of people doing songs and stuff. And it's like, it's pretty good. It's like maybe like rip off Kris Kristofferson stuff. It's just like, there's like very, very mid 80s sounding like adult radio music. And so if you're looking for some deep cut Christmas music, there's a song called Sleigh Rider that I think should be a hit.
That should be
right up there with Grandma Got Ran Over by a Reindeer, just a radio standard. But
we'll it's all it Perry happens. Botkin. So is he like a guy who just like he copies the styles of other musicians, or is that just like the guy who put it all together or something?
There's a couple different versions of the Silent Night, Deadly Night soundtrack on Spotify. And yeah, you're right. Half of it says Perry Botkin, and the other half says Morgan Ames. So maybe Perry Botkin is the score guy, and Morgan Ames is the singing guy. But either way, it's great. Yeah, and it does it. They just do kind of like country and then like adult contemporary pop. It's all music for people that were 43 in 1985. It's that exact genre. So check that out if you're into obscure Christmas music.
Do you remember the like Dr. Demento-y song about Silent Night, Deadly Night?
I don't think so.
Well, I mean, there was like maybe a week of my life where I was a super nerd for kind of like Weird Al when I was a kid, that kind of stuff. And I would do my best to stay up late for Dr. Demento. And there was a song that was like, Silent Night, Deadly Night, welcome to our show. I've never thought about till right now. So sleuths, go out and find that track. And maybe you could scoop Mike.
Yeah, you could. I always heard of Dr. Demento, but I never saw his show or anything. So
it's not really worth your time. In retrospect, it wasn't really worth my time. But I would walk around with like tapes of fish heads and stuff like that for a little while.
The other thing I have is kind of just like a half thought because I didn't really think it out. But I think I've been listening to a couple podcasts that are more pro, like podcasts that are just made to create revenue. There wasn't any like, you know, I have a creative passion to talk about this. It's just like, oh, let's come up with a topic and write like a 10-part series about it. And then rake in the dough. Mm-hmm. And I've noticed they all have a narrator and they all have the same voice. And it's kind of creepy. And it made me think that there has to be some kind of class or YouTube video. I looked today. I was like, there has to be a class and I couldn't find it. But it's just so strange. They all use like the same emphasis. They use the same accents, like the same inflections.
Yeah.
But it's totally different people. You know, after a while, like first I was like, it's probably just white people. It's just being overly white.
This is how we talk.
And then, yeah. And then I was just like, the one that I listen to on a regular basis, because I can't handle this podcast narrator voice. That's what I'm getting to. But yeah. So the only one I listen to on a regular basis is Proof, because it's about food. And I find the topics incredibly interesting. Mm-hmm. And so I deal with it. But that guy is an Asian guy. So I was like, okay, it's not just white guys. It's just maybe guys. But then today I listened to one called Operator about like the history of phone sex, and that's a woman doing it. And then I remember there was another food podcast I listened to that was also a woman. So it's just all different shapes and sizes of people doing the same voice, and I want so bad to do it, and I don't think I could. I think I would have to train for years to figure out this voice. And these people just have it like that. They just go into it and they know it. Like they just took a class and they're just out doing it. And I just want to know if people out there find this soothing. Like if you hear this and you're like, oh yes, this is the comfortable type of podcast. And cause maybe I sound abrasive cause you know, I don't sound like a pro. So maybe it's like, oh, those are those lower class shit podcasts that they don't know how to speak properly and stuff like that. I don't know how it is. I don't think you could do this voice if you're not reading from a script and getting thousands of takes in a professional studio, but I could be wrong. Scott, do you have any thoughts on this podcast narrator voice? Can it be done? Can it be done live? I guess, quote unquote, live, where we're not cutting every 2 minutes without a script. Like, I want to have this, what I assume people find soothing voice. And that's my other question is, do you find this like soothing and comforting?
I don't really like a single guy narrating unless it's really a topic that I dig. Like it's really got to be something I dig. I listen to Cocaine and Rhinestones, and I think that guy is just doing the hardcore history voice, and I find it a little abrasive.
Yeah.
Because he actually, you know, the like quote, blah, 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 quote. Jesus. Back off the mic, man. You're like eating the microphone when you say that. And, you know, sometimes you could tell, like I listened to I think it's Behind the Bastards, and that guy is clearly reading a script. He doesn't make any bones about it, but he's like obviously delivering a script, but he does it to a person, and he'll stop once in a while to let the person chime in on things, which I think is probably better because then at least you get some relief.
Yeah.
And you know, the single topic thing is like, I'll never listen to this because I don't really know anything about sports, but there's like a Giants podcast that keeps getting advertised on other podcasts I listen to. I'm like, how much could you say? Could you really say a weekly thing about the Giants all year? I mean, like football in general. Yeah, I get that. But what, like one team, you're just going to sit around and just keep talking about the Giants. Is there enough?
Yeah, for sure. Yes.
How?
I mean, if you're that type of fan, I don't know if there's enough to make people listen, but there's definitely enough if you're that type of fan to talk about.
Yeah, you're a fucking maniac. I'm telling you, you're a maniac if you just want to sit around and listen to people talk about the Giants every single week. There's a Kiss podcast called Three Sides of a Coin. That's one band, and they've been around for a long time. There's probably a lot to say about it, but I don't know if. I can't imagine there's fuel every single week to sit down and have like a 2 or 3 hour chat like these people do about Kiss.
Yeah, I was talking to JFD's Junk Food Dinner's Kevin Moss, and he's the one who told me about this Operator podcast. So, and it's one of those ones that's only X amount of episodes. So I was like, okay, fine. There's an ending to this, so I'll listen to it. I only find these hear about these podcasts when somebody else recommends them, because there's no way I would ever find them on my own, because it's just so fun. Like I'll see Spotify, Spotify always recommends me those types of podcasts. I'm just like, nope, not doing it. Yep. But yeah, so yeah, listeners out there, let me know if you find this shit comforting. If you hear that type of podcast and you're like, yes, this is the good stuff.
I got raked over the coals originally when Border Boss was just me. I was told by two different people that that I'm doing like NPR bullshit podcasting, so I stopped.
All those NPR and all the stuff I'm talking about, they have like the same warm sound, they have same very professional studio sound, and just the same like talking and like emphasizing every third word as if it's like the weirdest word they've ever heard, and just these weird inflections. But
yeah,
but just yeah,
savoring it.
If you want to let me know, you can reach out to first7inchclub@gmail.com or hit us up first7inchclub on Instagram or first7inchclub on YouTube. And those are all letters. There's no numbers in the first7inchclub. Today we are talking about a band that is a request. I got to point that out because we're going to probably start getting a reputation of being a very Hydra head heavy podcast. if I don't have mentioned this as a request, this is a request by Chris. This is a band called Union Suit and their 7-inch Accidents Happen. This came out in 1997 on Second Nature Records. As Chris wrote a little blurb, he emailed us about this in August, and so we're just getting to it. So made it before the end of the year, Chris. Hopefully you're still a listener. But he recommended a bunch of stuff. But Union Suit says it's pre-ISIS, better than Age of Reason. I assure you, our first episode was Age of Reason 7-inch. I've been obsessed with this record since I heard it and don't know why. My band made a Union Suit ripoff shirt once, and it was the coolest, most obscure thing I could think of. Apparently, there was supposed to be a discography on Hydra Head as advertised in late 90s zines, but it never happened. Union Suit was around, I think, very briefly from 95 to 97 or even 96 to 97. And they will probably be, if they're remembered for anything, it's being remembered for being Aaron Turner of ISIS's first band, not the terrorist group, but the actual band, if you are not a listener of this type of music. But yeah, it was his first band. And he was also in the band with Michael Poorman from Age of Reason that we talked about from the first episode. There was one other guy, Matt was the singer. So Josh, he was in Six Going on Seven and another band called Pale Throats and allegedly Cast Iron Hike. But it looks like he may have just been in Cast Iron Hike as performing live and not actually recording with them. But so he's been in some bands too. This was, as we said, pre-ISIS. And outside of a demo, that's all they had was a 7-inch. And I think the Wikipedia says something about how Aaron did not... he didn't like the direction the band was going or something like that, which is kind of like a cheese dick thing to say when you're like probably a teen and you're 1/7-inch deep or whatever. Like, I don't know. That's a Wikipedia. I don't really trust what Wikipedia says. So, but it's kind of a funny thing to think about a single 7-inch first band type of situation breaking up for, but whatever. This was a kind of a band to me that I heard of, and it seemed like, I don't know, when he wrote this down, I would have never thought of Union Suit as just a single 7-inch band. Like, I always, maybe it's because I lived in proximity to them, but they seem to be on like enough shows and they're around enough where I just always assumed they had, several records and stuff like that. And I just never paid attention to them. And I'm wrong. They only had this 1/7-inch, and I guess they are very obscure now, 20 some odd years later. And that's about it. I don't think I have any juicy history, because all you really need to know is this is one of the guys we always talk about on this show, one of the most influential guys in the history of heavy music, and it's his first band.
Yes, Mike, you see, music is a flat circle.
Yeah.
it's all completely interconnected. When we did Age of Reason and we saw that guy had done a lot of stuff, I never thought we'd meet again. I just didn't think he would just
no, me keep either, me either.
That thing, all these lines would just keep crashing back into each other. But this probably won't be the last time we meet. He's in a lot of stuff. Like, he has a lot of records in his discog, so yeah. I'm sure we'll see him again. Aaron Turner, I respect that this dude did a lot of exploration within his given lane. But to be honest, I dislike almost everything that that he has done, mostly because of him. Because I don't really love his shouting vocals that much. And, his career is all shouting. Like, I don't think he sings too much on many things. And so it's like, I just don't really like it that much. And, it's funny that he's like such a Neurosis guy, because he kind of reminds me of Neurosis, because Neurosis is a great band and everything Neurosis has done, I like, but they're a tent pole for a lot of bullshit. Neurot Records is like, it's the solo projects, all of those noisy things that come out in Neurot, all the tribal stuff, all that mishmash. I can't sink my teeth into any of that. I don't know if it's bad or good. I'm not saying it's bad. I just like, it's so far afield of the thing that you brought me to the party for. Like, I came here for Neurosis and you're giving me these like country records and stuff like that. And, Aaron Turner, he puts out like the occasional groundbreaking metal album, then surrounds it with like 4 or 5 ambient drone noise soundscape CDs. They probably ran you $25 You know, you get the thing home and you unfold all that crazy artwork and you're like, sweet. And you put the CD in and you paid $25 to listen to like a parking lot or something. Or a plucked acoustic guitar every once in a while. Like that, I don't know what band. He did one band that was just like ambient acoustic plucking. And I'm not the audience for that. I don't really even like metal gaze or, you know, any of that kind of stuff that much. So I've never been curious about this guy's past as a musician, apart from his decent label. And we keep confronting it. So I find it kind of like adorable and reprehensible. And we'll see what we think about this record.
Yeah, I never really understood that, how this, all these bands like Neurosis and then and Isis and all the like-minded bands somehow always had these side projects where they're playing like the wimpiest music. And obviously after a while, they just kind of leaned into the wimpy stuff and became wimpy bands. But it was just always strange because I didn't know anybody that liked that stuff. And I was always just like, oh, there must be people on the internet. But I don't know. I've never in my life ran into anybody who was like, oh yeah, I really like that wimpy music that's the thing. Now it seems like noise is back. Like there's all these noise shows and young people going to see noise and just guys playing with pedals and chords for who fucking knows how long. And that is just like,
yeah,
I mean, it doesn't really make me feel old because it was around when we were around, but it's like no one cared about it. So it's kind of just like, I don't know. I think that's a great Patreon idea, is just us live reacting to noise sets, because I don't know, like every once in a while, I'm just like, let me see if I get it now.
Yeah.
And I'll put it on for like 25 seconds.
I need the camera to be pointed at the front of the crowd because I got to see the guy who's pretending that he hears the beat and that it's his favorite thing and his life is changing.
I just don't get it. Like, I honestly don't know if they even have like compositions where they're just like, oh yeah, I got to turn this knob at 37 seconds and like turn this knob. I don't think so. I think this is all freeform bullshit and it's fucking like the greatest trick the devil ever pulled because it's all fucking nonsense. No one should be listening to it, but whatever. No. Anyways, this was put out by Second Nature Records. I don't know what Second Nature Records kind of lot in the world is now, if they're a known and remembered and celebrated record label, because it's not like I hear people talking about them. Oh, you know, they're still putting shit out, man. What the fuck? Are they? Yeah. A lot of this recent stuff seems like represses and stuff like that, so maybe they didn't really put it out. Oh, yeah, it looks like they kind of stopped putting out normal stuff in 2012, but that's still a lot longer than I thought they went for. But yes, I will always be in debt for Second Nature Records for their number one release, which was Coalesce, the self-titled EP. Yeah. There was a time in my life where there is no one that could be better than Coalesce. This is a band that I love so much from day one. Not exactly day one, because later on they released their pre-self-titled EP stuff, and it was really bad. But, you know, most people heard the self-titled EP and the 7-inch first, and then they immediately got signed to Relapse, which was one of the weirdest moves in hardcore metal music ever, where it was just like, huh, this band like got signed to Relapse like immediately. And that's like, I don't even think they played, like, you know, they played a few shows and they were just on Relapse and it was fucking crazy. You know, when Coalesce came out, they were just like the heaviest thing I ever heard. So I forever will love Second Nature for that. But they put out some other good stuff too. They put out a comp shortly after that called A Document of Nothing, which I really liked a lot back then. They put out a band called Krakatoa, which is not the famous Krakatoa, but a different one. Actually, I don't know. Maybe it is the famous one. then, you know, Union Suit. Then they hit that Get Up Kids that was popular, not with me, but a lot of people like them. Grade, which now I didn't even know they put out Separate the Magnets, so that kind of makes sense that they also put out this Union Suit record, which, spoiler alert, but then a lot of other cool stuff. An Isis record, Casket Lottery, Waxwing, a lot of stuff that wasn't in my lane but was kind of a big hit back then. The Blood Brothers, that was another big hit. And so they had this kind of longer legacy that I guess died in the early 2000s for most people, but it does look like they just kept releasing stuff that no one was really listening to going into the later 2000s. But I mean, it's not like the stuff, I think this is just like all re-releases. I can't really look at it, but like they're releasing like Rocky I never knew how to say that guy's name, Rocky Votolato records like in 2007. I don't know if those are new or not. They did like a Coalesce re-release in 2008, so it seems like the tail end of their discography is mostly re-releases, but I will always be in debt to this record label. I always liked their logo, which seemed pretty like pro and cool back in the 90s, like definitely a lot more pro looking than most record label logos. So big fan of Second Nature.
I kind of go the other way on it, because I feel like they back then they weren't a label I could rely on, because you know, like Coalesce is great, but Coalesce guy forms a new band and he gets to be on Second Nature, but that's pop punk. And all those heavy guys started forming pop punk bands. Like, what are you doing? Stop forming pop punk bands. And, you know, I can't remember the name, but there's another well-known record on there that's like Gentle Math Rock. Like, it's a name. I can't think of the name, but you'd know.
It's not Waxwing, is it?
No, I mean,
Sharks Keep Moving.
Yeah. It's pretty gentle. It's good. That's cool record, but it's like, it's pretty gentle, and I think it might even be instrumental. I can't remember if there's vocals on it. So when I was young, I would see that Second Nature logo, and I just didn't even think of it as like a label. You know, I just thought of like a distro.
Like, it does look like a distro. Like, it does look like a manufacturing or something like type of label. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, when I was a kid, I bought up all the Metallica. Metallica again. But I bought up all the Metallica I could find, and they were on Elektra. But if you bought like their EPs and the weirdo one-off things, they'd be on Music for Nations, which had this really crazy, like, propaganda-looking logo. I was always just like, what the fuck is Music for Nations? Is it a label? Is it a distro? Is it like a? Is it just some sort of weird overseas agreement that has a name? And so when I would see the Second Nature thing, it looks like when you pull the plug off your computer and it has like all those Underwriters Laboratories logos on it that let you know that it's safe to plug into the wall without getting shocked. That's what that logo kind of makes me think of. It's just like, this record won't burn your house down. It's fine.
So I guess we get into the record, the actual packaging itself. This is pretty simple, two fold over. There's a, you know, just fold it over once, and that's what you got. You get an inside and outside. There was no insert with this. I have the black vinyl version. There is a white vinyl version. And as far as I could tell from Discogs, there was no difference. There was no like lyric sheet or pamphlet or anything like that. So, you know, first you could tell there's no lyrics in this. So this guy, the singer, very ashamed of himself, very ashamed of the things he's saying. Mm-hmm. He's like, no, you don't need to print my lyrics. They're bullshit. So that's cool. It's always cool when singers can just be like, yeah, it's not that important, whatever. You'll get a little Easter egg. You'll see the live photos were done by one Jacob Bannon in the liner notes. It's a famous guy from Converge. But the actual cover, that's kind of a wraparound cover. It is art by Aaron Turner. So if this was his first band, this is, you know, probably one of his first published type of art pieces. Mm-hmm. And that's it's his other thing he's been known for since besides his bands. It's nothing to write home about. It's kind of a beige-ish color, like painted beige almost. Mm-hmm. And it's like a little tiny fragmented pictures of an airplane, like a kind of a childish illustration. And that wraps around, and it has the literal typewriter font on it, like an actual typewriter going to work on this. Again, 1997, and we're in the thick of it. That's where when you're going to see the most of it. It does a really annoying thing of it's only a 3-track 7-inch, and putting all 3 tracks out of order. I don't know if they thought that was cool to write them in different sequential order or what, but that's just dumb. That's not. It's amazing how difficult some things were back when there was no internet. There was no real internet to be like, I wonder if that's a typo or, you know, the name of the song is this, because they don't print the name of the song titles on the actual label either, so you don't know. And there's really no way to check back then. And now people would just be like cast into hell for doing something as stupid as like doing something that's not Googleable. So it's just pretty crazy. The layout itself is that kind of clean layout that I think Hydra Head would be known for like later on, not for this record, but it's, you know, it's just like really a lot of negative space, a lot of spaced out letters. I was definitely not a fan of it back then. Like, I would just be like, ugh, it's fucking boring. Now I appreciate it. Now I think it looks clean, and looking, you know, what it came from, looking at like the 90s, just like shitty rip a paper off of an encyclopedia type of thing. I can see these guys were really doing something. This is like a real revolution in art and a hardcore of, you know, actually knowing how to use a computer and layout software and stuff like that. So I appreciate it now. Unfortunately, the pictures are almost illegible because it looks like this was supposed to be color. Like, this was supposed to be a color CD booklet, and they got hosed, and they had to make it in just black and white. And so the photos are a little hard to make out, but outside of that, it looks clean. This band itself musically is kind of a little hard to categorize, especially if you aren't familiar with 90s music. So I don't know if I would look at this cover and be like, I got to know more about this, because it's just kind of whatever. Like this could be like an alt rock band for all I know. So
yeah,
I don't know if this cover would have sold me, but I don't hate it. I think it's just for a guy that would go on to be known for his design work. You know, well, I guess it's an okay start. It's not the best. You weren't immediately like, hey, I have some records with some early Derek Hess art, and it's very not good. So, you know, everybody needs to start somewhere. So it's a fine attempt, clean layout, 1997, that we were in the thick of that type of layout. So I get it.
I dislike and have always disliked the cute emo cartoon thing.
Yeah.
It makes my skin crawl. I think that this record is going for a dichotomy between two things, which I would usually respect, but because there's an emo cartoon involved, I don't respect it. And this cover is firing on all cylinders to do that cute thing. And it's supposed to be ironic that it's depicting probably an airplane crash, I assume, and also jarring to have it paired with the I don't know what that is inside. Is that like from a Fulci movie, or is that from Creepshow? There's like a beheading.
Yeah, I couldn't tell if that was just one of the guys goofing around, but I guess no, that's just a decapitated head.
Yeah, and, second one looks real.
The big picture is just a different angle of it. I didn't recognize that.
It looks like an actual cartel beheading after like a Brujeria. Yeah,
it could be. Yeah. It could be, which is pretty death metal. So.
Right. That's the thing. It's like this is a pretty mild layout, but it has cutesy stuff, and then it has like a possible real beheading inside. Yeah. And it's all wrapping paper for this heavy band. You know, it's cute things, but it's a heavy band inside. And that would be great. I wouldn't have a problem with any of that, except that they did this 90s emo graffiti cartoon style, and I hate it. I hate it. I hate it. I hate it. And I think the layout, other than that, is fine. Like, I think the scratchy texture they got in the cover is quality. And, you know, whatever you did with the Brujeria picture in the inside, go for it. That's fine.
Okay. We get into the music now. This is a 3-track record. This is a very rare 3 tracks. They couldn't fit 4 tracks. But
I guess.
Yeah. I mean, they could have if they tried, but they just didn't bother. So it's very odd to do that. So the first song is called Suicide Doors. This song, if you have your headphones turned up, starts off with a little Delta Blues sample, just sampling a Delta Blues song, and that was a trend back then that people did. I was confused by it back then, but now I just hate it. Like, I hate any time I stumble upon more music that I haven't heard that does that, because it was just like, again, it was like kind of an emo screamo staple, and I don't understand. I've never understood what. Scott's most referenced band, Cap'n Jazz, I think they started it. I don't know if that's could possible be. But I think they are the first ones that I remember, and I just don't understand what the symbolism is. I don't understand what's going through these bands' minds, where they're like, oh, if we start our record off with old-timey music, then people will be like, oh yes, this is it. This is what I was looking for. Like, I don't know what the point of it is, but it's dumb. I hate it. I'm glad it's not a trend anymore. I probably legally can't be a trend now that the internet exists. I think your record would be algorithmed to hell if you did that. So, I guess this is screamo. I guess this is something somebody would call screamo. To me, it's just kind of like these guys were an emo band, and the guitarist decided to, which is Aaron Turner, decided to distort his amp, but maybe Scott's the guitar guy, so hopefully he could clarify for me, but it's not like, it's not normal. It sounds broken. Like it sounds very defined. Like he was like, I'm going to make like a, my own signature shit sound of a shit guitar. It's just like, because like you listen to the rest of the recording and it's very clear. Like it's a very good recording for 1997 for like an old used record that I have. Like it's, you could hear everything clearly. So at first I was like, oh, this just sounds like a shitty record. But then you listen and you're like, those drums and the bass and everything's like very clear on this. And then you have this insane sounding guitar. I don't hate it, but I definitely don't love it. I would like to hear them do this over again with a different guitar sound and let me weigh the difference, because I'm not sure about it. Outside of that, there's some cool background vocals in this that actually sound like a ghost is singing them, because they're like very low and kind of distant.
I think
it might just be the singer's, like I think he just doubled the vocals and just put them like off time and very distant, or whoever recorded it did that for him, and it sounds pretty cool. It's like the one kind of thing that sticks out for me in this song. Like the song isn't bad or anything, it's just kind of like very standard, even though they're definitely trying to do something weird. But what came out is definitely what I would call the weakest track on the record.
The Delta Blues things also put you in league with Moby, so congrats. Like he was doing this then too. Like I think that album where he famously sampled some some old blues records is 96 or something like that.
Yeah.
I think this song is fantastic. I like this song. Okay. I like that they keep, I mean, I like that, that sample's got to fly by, and it does. It just goes by. Yeah. So fine. It's just kind of like a little mood thing, I think, to contrast with, which like, again, I think the same thing as the record. They started off with this like, mild thing and then, crash into it with their screamo thing. But that trip, this sort of triplet, like this, I love that. I'll do it again. It's like, it's something that sounds complicated and busy when it's not, like, cause this song is really not that complicated. It's like two parts, but because it's got that kind of like, it just makes it sound exciting. I assume that this was Aaron on vocals. You said the other guy was doing the vocalist, but
I believe so. Not positive, but I believe so. Yeah.
It's like, if it's not, they're the same kind of guy. They're both not very good at screaming. And, I think I don't mind it on this, I guess, as much, because I think it's kind of cool when the band is blazing along and the singer is just really ragged and dying on the vine and barely able to keep up. I don't mind it as much, I guess. It's not as bad as when it's over like powerful metal. Like if you're a really powerful metal band, your singer's going, duh! It just doesn't really do it for me. And I kind of love that the drums sound like they're produced at like Bearsville Studios by Todd Rundgren or something, when the rest of it sounds like a boombox. Like these guitars, the bass, they sound like
they're. Do you have any theories about what's going on with this guitar, since you actually have like technical know-how?
I don't remember when it started happening, but when Converge lost a guitarist and they kind of went for like a clankier sound.
Yeah.
Because they used to have a really, just like everybody else, they had like the high gain metal sound. And then when they came back, it almost sounded like they switched to Telecasters or something. Or going, it had like a twang. And suddenly, boom, it was like the Big Bang. All white-belted, swoopy-haired people had to turn down the gain and buy like more powerful amps to get that clanging sound. And that gave, I think that gave us Djent. Because Djent is a lot of single string. Yeah. I mean, I know Meshuggah really gave us Djent, but the sound of that kind of dong, 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 that just like letting the string sound like that. I don't know when it started, though. I don't know if this can't be a part of it. I think he just has a shitty sound. It sounds like he had a hand-me-down, like he had a Fender amp or something weird that you wouldn't use for heavy stuff and just pinned it as hard as it would go. And whatever guitar his mom bought him, he just went for it and just tried to make it heavy. But the bass is like, and the guitar is like, and the drums are like, and then the vocals sound fine. So the everything, it's kind of a clash. It's interesting. And I kind of like it. It comes off as noisy in a way that I don't mind. And it gets weirder as the record goes on.
So the second track is called Condolence Card. We'll be right back. This is where, I mean, he was doing it on the first track too, but this is where you'll notice the vocalist is doing a lot of repeating lyrics, where I think there's only about three lines to this song and they stretch it out about for about 2 minutes. And you could, I mean, with between this and the fact that they didn't even publish the vocals, you can tell this guy is more into using his voice as an instrument instead of trying to say anything. And that's cool, like, because that's, you know, that's kind of the deal. He's doing, like, even during the quieter parts of these songs, especially this one, he's still doing, like, a rasp! Like, he's making sure to put, like, you know, some type of inflection on his vocals. So, maybe because he's embarrassed, I don't know. but either way, you know, he's purposely doing things vocally to stand out. And so I don't think the lyrics were that important. So, that's fine. You don't print them. You just want to say the same fucking seven words over and over again. That's fine. Yeah. ISIS would make a career out of it. So it makes sense that they have this lineage. This song has a little happy swaying emo part to it that gives it a lot more depth than I think the first song. And they kind of do the thing where they build off that into a quiet part, into like the heavy building part where it just kind of like releases and you're like, yeah, that's what I was looking for. It was definitely like a trend back then. That was like a mind-blowing thing to do, where people would be like, I didn't even know you could do that. I didn't even know you could have a soft song and then go into this heavy part. So it's pretty cool. I think these songs are kind of all in order for me, where the first one's mild, the second one's medium, and the third one's spicy. So it makes sense this one's in the middle. Again, pretty good song, but I just don't know if any of this really translates to the 2021 2022 human ear. So I don't know, but I dug it though.
One of my favorite records, you know, I talk about six records on this show at all times, and I've probably said it before, but I like there's an Iconoclast record that is, it's screamo, it's just full screamo, he's always screaming, but there's one song called I Like You Less Than Apple Pie where he just sings, and it's almost like it's basically a pop song. So that's the song I like. I bought the screamo record, but they put out a wimpy song. I like the wimpy song, and this reminds me of it in the beginning. It has almost the same sound and almost the same kind of vocals. I just think the only problem with it is it never gets catchy. It's trying to do that, but it never has. It doesn't have any memorable parts. It just sounds like out of breath, random emo. But exactly halfway through, they have their From Dusk Till Dawn moment. They just change the song. Oh yeah, well, how about this? And they just start screaming. They all turn into vampires and start screaming. And it like justifies the first half. Like, oh okay, you guys, that's what that was. You guys. And I only asked for two things out of this world. I asked for multi-track screaming and slams, and I think that this song tried to give me both. So. They tried to fuck with me for half a song on it. That's fun. Who does that? Who does that anymore? Who does the good cop, bad cop song? And I think that the screaming your way out part of this is so different that it's strange. It's almost like doomy. Like it's a little bit ISIS-y maybe. I don't know. It predicts stuff that he didn't get to for another few years after this.
So then you flip it over and the lone track on side B is Exeter. This song's a bouncy little number. This is it's kind of a little bouncy in the beginning. It honestly, if you change that guitar to sounding like a normal guitar, this would basically be a Promise Ring song or something. It does sound, it's a little Grade-y. I think these guys do Grade better than Grade, and Grade got pretty popular at one point, and then kind of just lost any edge. If you guys don't know what Grade was, they were like the band that popularized being like kind of wimpy, but then going into like stupid heavy parts.
Yeah.
And but they, as soon as they got popular, they immediately pivoted just to the wimpy stuff. They're like, okay, well, yeah, it seems more girls like the wimpy stuff, so let's just lean on that. But the first couple things they released were that's the closest I could pin Union Suit to is Grade. But I think, like I said, I think this song is probably better than most of Grade's songs from that era. And they nailed it. Maybe that was what the difference is that Aaron had with the rest of the band, where they wanted to go into wimpy great stuff, but I don't know. They definitely want this to be the hit. I know that. Even the catchiness from the last track that Scott was missing there, they're trying to make this as catchy as possible. Personally, like I think I would say this is my favorite song on the record, but I personally don't know if this would have been the hit back then, or somebody would have picked Condolence Card over this, because it's neck and neck for me of what would have actually been the hit for 1997. But they are definitely trying to make a hit, because it eventually builds into a very stompy, possibly purposeful mosh part. I couldn't tell if they really wanted people to mosh or that's just how it ended. But it's very, very, very similar to the famous mosh part from a song called The Saddest Day by a band called Converge, who released that song, you know, probably months before this one. So I'm not saying they're plagiarized, because it's possible that they actually wrote this song before Converge wrote The Saddest Day. I don't know. I'm just saying these two guys being friends, being in close proximity with each other, and one of those bands made this mosh part extremely popular, and it wasn't Union Suit. So if they ripped off Converge, fine. You got what you deserve. Nothing. No fame. You would have to start another band for fame. But if Converge ripped them off, then I don't know. I think you owe Aaron Turner forever, Jacob Bannon. Yeah. Yeah. But either way, yeah, this is the big finish. I get what they're going for. If you know you only had to listen to one track on this record, just flip it right over to side B and listen to it.
I think, yeah, I think we got a lot of this stuff later, but I think it's kind of weird that there was screamo bands, there was emo bands, there was post-hardcore bands, and sometimes it overlapped, but not a lot. And yeah, I was listening to this record, and I thought the exact same thing. I thought of Grade, and that's it. Yep. End of line. I can't think of another band that had kind of like catchy, almost major key, emo-y or post-hardcore-y guitars, but the singer screaming. That's just, it really wasn't a lot of that back then. And that would go into just full on Mongo parts after that. It didn't happen. Nobody did it. Maybe like local bands. There might be some bands that, you know, people know from their own scenes, but, it's like Union Suit and Grade, who would take like a piebald track and scream on it. Like nobody else is really doing it. You scooped me on almost everything on this song, because the thing that I would notice about this is that this record is a journey. I thought it was sort of the other way around, where the intro was a ripper. And the second, like, to prove the credentials, like, here we are, this is our ripper. And then they gave you the stunt track in the middle. Like, here's a pussy part. Is this okay? can we get away with that? And then this last one is the full synthesis. This is like,
okay, yep. You know, I like, see that. I see it
all together. And you can tell that they're like pretty, even whether you like the sound or not, they're pretty good at their instruments, because it's got all the skittery picking. And it's got the precise little picking. Seven layers of tortured yowling on top. I think they got away with it. I think this record gets away with it. They didn't get anything out of it, but I think that this could be. I've heard this for the first time in 2021, and I liked it. I thought that this was cool. I think it's memorable. So, ears of 2021, find this Union Suit. Let me know. I think it's new. It's a new sound. Even to this day, no one is screaming over poppy parts. It's kind of a them and Kveller tack, I guess.
I honestly think it's just because it was a moment in time, because I mean, by 2001, maybe a little after, by the early 2000s, bands were just had great production and super clean parts and stuff like that. So this was just kind of like the beginning of that, and it just got super corny super quick. So I don't even know if somebody could replicate this and make it sound genuine. I don't know. Kids do so much shit now that sounds exactly like stuff in the 90s.
Yeah.
Like my favorite record, my favorite like heavy hardcore music record of the year is this band called Contention. And it's just like some fucking demo like they released. And it just sounds exactly like like Congress and Acme and just all that stuff, like with no real like wink to it. It just sounds like that shit, and it's amazing. So you know, maybe kids will find something like this and rip it off. Yeah. But I guess overall, did you have more to say or no?
No, that's it. Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, overall, I forgot to mention two things at the top. First, if you guys didn't know, I don't want, you know, any fact checkers to come after us, but this band was from Massachusetts, in case you were wondering, just in case you didn't know. And secondly, I just wanted to point out that a union suit is just old timey pajamas.
And yeah, sure are.
It's a cool sounding word that I definitely didn't know what it meant back then, but I know what it means now. And now it's a weird thing to name your band after, but you know,
yeah. So it's the old, I don't know if teens will get this reference, if teens listen to us, but in the old cartoons, they would have the Hatfields and the McCoys.
Yeah,
fighting, and like the guy would jump out of the outhouse in his red union suit with the ass flap still open and have his musket and chase a rabbit around or something like that.
Yep, that's so yeah, it's an odd thing to name your band after. But I overall, my rating scale is put the shit right in the garbage. Buy it for her clearance, buy it for full price, or buy it for collector's prices. And as Scott said, this is kind of a unique thing. This doesn't really exist anymore. And on top of that, I mean, Jacob Bannon only really did a few photos in this, but it's still something that Jacob Bannon and Aaron Turner kind of combined forces to do. This is, again, Aaron Turner's first band and like one of his first published like layouts. So this is kind of just like finding out that like Jim Lee or Rob Liefeld and like Grant Morrison just did a power pack comic, like an issue of Power Pack, like in 1987. And you're just like, huh. And so it probably still sucked because it was Power Pack. But it's just like, it's just definitely like, it's a piece of history where you're just like, whoa, I can't believe this isn't more of a known thing just for the people involved. And so it is kind of weird that this went by the wayside. I will say that the white version is definitely collector's prices. You're not getting that unless you're going to shell out at least $15-$20. And that is unfortunately because while everybody was sleeping in America, everybody in Europe bought every single copy of every single hardcore record ever released. So now you have to import them back into America for some reason. So, yeah, I think the white one goes for $15-$20. This one you can probably still get between $2 and $4. And I do think that's highway robbery. As I've said hundreds of times, well, only about 25 times on the show, I grade on the full package on everything included, and nothing on this record, layout wise or anything, interest wise or anything, is 5 stars. But I think this record is, you know, it's the sum is more than its parts. And I think for me, this is a collector price record all day. You should definitely have this in your collection. It's a piece of history. It's an interesting sound that does not exist anymore. Even the guitar alone is interesting enough to be like, this is notable. I should pick this up and listen to it. So collector prices all day for me, even if anything, if anything else on this record isn't completely remarkable on its own, just altogether, it's remarkable.
I want it on record. I think Aaron Turner should hire other people to sing. And if this isn't Aaron and he hired this guy, then he needs to hire the next guy. He needs to keep going down the line. Aside from a few sonic shortcomings on this album, some of which I actually kind of didn't mind, and my utter contempt for the cover and the cute cartoons, I think that this record is very memorable. It's probably one of the more memorable things I think we've listened to so far. I think I'll listen to it again on purpose, which is weird. I don't listen to anything twice. I thought it was really good. I really enjoyed it, despite everything. 1997 is the year Helmet put out Aftertaste. So maybe this record helped slay the unwitting grandfathers of groove metal. I also think this is the year that my ska metal band got an offer to open for Taproot, and we declined. We said no. So I might have had a hand in fighting groove metal as well. But I'm going to award this as a full package. I award this album a 4, but musically a 4.7. Very long dyed groove metal bassist goatees out of 5, which they can wear them as a warning, like a finger necklace in war, to let approaching groove metalers know that they are not welcome. They're on warning.
So there you go. This is a pretty highly rated record. Thanks, Chris, for recommending it. You definitely hit it out of the park. That's why we count on you guys out there to recommend us stuff. So if you want to do so, hit us up on our Instagram, First 7-Inch Club, or if it's too private, it's too secret, you can hit us up on email, first7inchclub@gmail.com. You could always go to our YouTube to hear all of these records if you need a, you know, a little more, a little better taste than what you hear on there. And yeah, that's about it. I hope you guys have a happy holiday. I think we'll have one more episode before the end of the year. We'll see. It's a dicey time. I don't know if you guys have checked the news lately, but pretty bleak stuff. So we'll see what we're doing next week. But till then, I'll talk to you later.
Well, I'll be inside, so I got nothing else to do. I'll be inside forever. So I got nothing else to do.
Yeah, we'll all be inside. So you guys got time to work on my podcast voice, and you got time to listen to more podcasts out there.
We'll be up to two a week by the time